Jacob is on his way home, on his way back to his father Isaac, on his way from the years of service that he has given to his uncle Laban. He has made his peace with his uncle. They have parted on reasonably good terms, and Jacob has continued on his journey with a hope and an expectancy of being reconciled also with his brother. A brother whose last words had indicated a determination to kill Jacob because of his deceptive treatment of him. Jacob has changed. He's not the man that he was when he left the land of Canaan 20 years earlier. He has himself been on the receiving end of deceitful behavior. He has learned hard lessons, and he has come to trust in the God of his father Isaac and the God of his grandfather Abraham for himself. Nevertheless, as he has continued in hope, news from messengers that he has sent ahead of himself has come back, filling him with a foreboding. Yes, his brother Esau is still alive, and he's coming to meet him, but he has with him a band of 400 men. It sounds like an army, and it fills Jacob with fear. At last, the hour which Jacob has dreaded arrives. And at the beginning of the 33rd chapter, we read that Jacob lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau was coming, and 400 men with him. There on the horizon, he is seen. And Jacob is filled with fear. There's much evidence of his fear in this passage. He has already confessed his fear earlier in a prayer to God in chapter 32. "Deliver me," he cries out, "from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, that he may come and attack me, the mothers, with the children." And now, as he sees his brother on the horizon, he makes one last ditch attempt to provide some form of protection for his family, at least for Rachel and for Joseph. He sets his wives and children in some sort of order, with the servants ahead of Leah, who herself is ahead of Rachel, the one whom he loves, and Joseph, her only son. There seems not only a formality in the way that Jacob is preparing to present his wives and children before his brother, but there also seems a determination that if everything should go bad, Rachel and Joseph, at least being in the rear, have some chance, possibly, of escape. Jacob's fears are evident in this story. Furthermore, he has already, as we saw last time, sent on ahead of him gifts. Not a token gift, but a rather extravagant gift of livestock sent in 5 bands ahead of him in order to placate Esau, turn away his anger, find, in his own words, favour with his brother. When Esau eventually arrives and asks him about this, this is his own confession. "These are to find favour in the sight of my Lord." And over again, Jacob uses this language of submission, of humility, He refers to his brother as my Lord. He's emphatic about him being a servant to him. He insists on this gift being received. Please, if I have found favour in your sight, then accept my present from my hand. He is determined that Esau should receive this gift and in receiving it demonstrate an acceptance of his brother, that there would now be peace between them. The old enmity and hatred should no longer continue. Jacob indeed is full of fear. Indeed, later on in the story, when Esau accepts the gift and then says, well, we'll travel together to the land of Seir, Jacob refuses. Refuses an escort, refuses the help of some of these 400 men who have accompanied Esau, refuses to have anything to do with Esau that would in some way or other tie him to him. He still doesn't entirely trust his brother. And rather than heading in the direction of Seir in the south, we read that once Esau departs, Jacob journeys to Succoth, which was most likely at the point that Jacob is at this time, to the north, in the opposite direction. And then rather than heading towards the place where his brother lives, he heads into the promised land, into the land of Canaan, settling in Shechem. Indeed, it would appear that Jacob has no intention of joining his brother in Seir. Jacob, indeed, is full of fear. Understandable fear, considering the words that Esau had spoken that had resulted in Jacob's hasty flight from his home to that of his uncle. An understandable fear, considering that there was this great band of men coming towards him along with his brother. And yet, we see that the story doesn't turn out the way that Jacob had feared. This band of men, however they may have been initially intended, do not fight with Jacob and his sons and the servants that they may have with them, accompanying them, looking after the animals. No, they stand back and Esau runs forward and embraces Jacob. There's a reconciliation. Well, it's not entirely surprising, is it? After all, Jacob had prayed to God for this very thing. Deliver me from my brother. And it is God who holds the hearts of kings in his hand. It is he who directs them in whichever way he wants. We see the hand of God in this unfolding story of Jacob's life, and we see it in this chapter too. God has answered Jacob's prayer. And Esau comes then with a generosity of spirit that Jacob never dared to expect. Jacob was fearful. In the end, without any grounds, considering who was on his side. He has proved the promises of God that God had made to him at Bethel, that he would be with him, that he would protect him, that he would prosper him, and that he would bring him back. And here again we see evidence of God's faithfulness to Jacob as God's plans and purpose for redemption unfold in the life of this man. But in this story, not only do we see Jacob's fears, but we get a glimpse into Jacob's heart. Remember, I said that the 20 years of service under Laban have changed Jacob's heart. He's a different man from the man that left all those years earlier. God has been at work in his life. And I've made reference already to the fact that Jacob desired a reconciliation with his brother. A reconciliation that wasn't simply a matter of ensuring peace, so that he wouldn't have to live out his life in Canaan, constantly looking over his shoulder in case Esau should appear, out for revenge. No, the reconciliation that Jacob desires is a reconciliation that recognizes his own wrongdoing. And we get hints of that within this very passage. Why was it that Esau had undertaken to kill Jacob? What was it that had led to Jacob fleeing? Well, Jacob had stolen the blessing. He had dressed himself up like Esau. He had made sure that his blind father would feel and smell his eldest son, not the younger son. He had deceptively gone into Jacob, his mother having prepared a meal that his father loved, and he had stolen the blessing of his father that had been intended for Esau. And what we discover in this passage, that as Jacob approaches Esau, he behaves towards him according to the blessing that Isaac had intended to give to Esau. What was that blessing that Isaac had intended? It was a blessing that incorporated servitude of a brother. Let people serve you and nations bow down to you. Be lord over your brothers, and may your mother's sons bow down to you. And what do we see as Jacob approaches his brother? 7 times he prostrates himself before his brother. This is far more than the normal rules of etiquette would have demanded. Jacob is conveying a message to his brother. In bowing down to Esau, he is acknowledging that the blessing that he stole was rightly his older brother's. Furthermore, that blessing had incorporated the promise of prosperity. May God give you of the dew of heaven and of the fatness of the earth and plenty of grain and wine. And Jacob sends before him gifts for his brother, insists that his brother accept these gifts. And look how he refers to these gifts. He says, please accept my blessing that is brought to you, because God has dealt graciously with me and because I have enough. Please accept my blessing. The language is that of the blessing of Isaac upon him, a blessing that had been stolen. And in effect, Jacob is confessing then to Esau that what is his, what is Jacob's, should be Esau's. There's another interesting thing that comes out here in this section. Jacob also makes reference to what happened the previous night. No doubt Esau himself would not have understood the expression. Jacob says to him, if I have found favor in your sight, then accept my present from my hand. For I have seen your face, which is like seeing the face of God, and you have accepted me." Do you remember what happened the previous night? He had sent his family across the ford to protect them, to make sure that this river was between them and this approaching army, as Jacob understood it to be. And then he had encountered a mysterious man with whom he had wrestled through the hours of the night. And at the end of that story, we observed that Jacob understood this man to have been God in appearance as a man. "I have seen the face of God," he said, "and lived." His life was delivered. And now he has seen Esau's face. He has seen the face of his brother, a brother who had promised that he would kill him. And again, his life has been delivered. He has been accepted. And this is the outworking, you see, of the grace of God in a person's life. God and Jacob have been reconciled. Jacob has found the favour of God, and now he has found the favour of man. He has become right with God. He has been blessed by God, and now he is right with his brother, and has been blessed by his brother through being accepted by him. Jacob's heart has been changed because he has encountered God and has been transformed by God. And that has worked out then with his other relationships. He's not simply trying to be at peace with Esau because he doesn't want to always be fearful of his life. No, he wants to be at peace with Esau because it's the right thing to do. It's a very encouraging sign in Jacob's life. And yet, though Jacob has encountered God, been blessed by God, even to the point of being given a new name by God, no longer is he Jacob, deceiver, cheat. He is now Israel, one who fights with God, or for whom God fights. He has God on his side. And yet, Jacob is still here. The old Jacob is still here. We saw it, didn't we? Esau suggests that they travel together back to Seir. And Esau says, and Jacob says, "No, no, that's not my direction. I'm heading to Canaan. I'm heading to my father's house. That is where God has commanded me to go." No, that's not what he says at all, is it? He says, "No, we'll hold you back. I've got children with me. They wouldn't survive the pace of your army. And the flocks and the herds, you know, even one day driven hard, and they'll all die. I'll come on slowly, and I'll come to my Lord and Savior." But Jacob has no intention of going to Seir. We see that immediately following. As soon as Esau leaves, Jacob heads off in another direction. Commentators suggest that Esau probably understood this. He probably recognized what Jacob was saying in this. Whether Esau understood or not, the point is that Jacob slips into his old ways of deceit. of lying. So we have great encouragement and then this sort of disappointment. There was so much promise here. An increasing confidence in God and being blessed by God, and you would hope then that Jacob would take the next step and be bold in his response to Esau. After all, over and over and over again, he has acknowledged God before his brother. These are the children whom God has graciously given your servant. Seeing you is like seeing the face of God, because you've accepted me. And over again, he has acknowledged God, and then suddenly, rather than acknowledging God's command and God's will and his determination to obey God, he lies about his intentions and slips into his old ways. It seems so disappointing. And then we see that in Jacob's heart there is this desire to honour God. Yes, he's already acknowledged God before his brother a number of times. Furthermore, he does also acknowledge God by moving in the direction of Canaan. Though initially he heads north to Succoth, he then crosses over into the land of Canaan to a place called Shechem. It is the land of promise. It is the land that God has given to his family. And there, he acknowledges God by erecting an altar and calling it El Elohi Israel, God, the God of Israel. Yes, he honours God. He acknowledges God. God is his God. And yet, at the same time, he fails in complete obedience to this God. He journeys to Succoth, then he carries on to Shechem, and there he buys land, and he erects an altar, and he worships God there. But what's he doing in Shechem? Why is he in Shechem? When God commanded him to return to the land of Canaan, he made reference to the place of Bethel. He didn't command Jacob to go to Bethel, but he did refer to the fact that he is the God of Bethel. He commands Jacob to go back to his fathers, go back to his land. And technically you could argue, well, he is in the land. Here in Shechem, he's in the land. But later on in chapter 35, God more specifically commands him to arise from Shechem and go up to Bethel and dwell there. You know, it's apparently only about 20 miles away, if commentators are right on their assessment of where Shechem is. 20 miles. Why didn't he go to Bethel? Maybe Shechem was a good place in which to settle and to rebuild his flocks and herds. After all, he's given a lot of livestock away to his brother. Maybe it seems to be a more prosperous place in which to settle. Whatever it is, there is an indication here that despite Jacob's honouring of God, it isn't resulting in complete and total obedience to God. And we'll see next time that this failure to complete and total obedience will bring some nasty results upon his family. Let me conclude by pointing out that Jacob had some genuine fears. Some real fears must be faced with trust in God. And God proved himself to Jacob. But Jacob, though he's a transformed man, though he's a different man from the man that left 20 years earlier, he's not a perfect man. He's a man who follows God. He's a man who trusts in God. He's a man who prays to God. He's a man who walks with God. But he doesn't do it perfectly. It's a picture to us, really, of the Christian. The Christian who is justified through faith in Jesus Christ. His sins are washed away. He has peace with God. But he's not perfect yet. There's a process of sanctification that is ongoing throughout life. This is what's happening with Jacob. He is God's man. But he's not yet God's perfect man. And we may be a child of God. We may be a follower of Jesus Christ, but we're not yet a perfect follower of Jesus Christ. Every now and again, things will be said, things will be done that reveal the old David, the old Jacob. Still there. And we need to recognize that in one another. We need to recognize that in our interaction with one another, the old man will show himself at times. And we need to bear and forbear with one another. We need to be patient with one another. We have a tendency to expect from others perfect Christ-likeness. And when we don't get perfect Christ-likeness, we feel hurt, we feel used, we feel ill-treated, we feel let down. We feel abandoned. We feel all kinds of things. But it doesn't mean that this isn't a brother or a sister in Christ. It doesn't mean that they're not making progress in their walk with the Lord. It simply means that this justified person is being sanctified and hasn't yet reached perfection. We need to realize that in ourselves and be always ready to acknowledge our failings. It is no shame to acknowledge our failings. It is folly to try and hide them, pretend that it didn't happen, or try to justify ourselves when we behave in sinful ways. No, let us acknowledge, let us humble ourselves. Let us seek forgiveness and reconciliation. And then we will know the full outpouring of God's blessing upon us and his help to continue to walk with him through all of life.